From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, dancer and choreographer Bill T. Jones. You may have recently seen his piece Still Here on public television. It's based on conversations he had with people dealing with life-threatening illnesses. Also today, an interview with Mel Torme. There's a new CD box set of his recordings. Film critic John Powers reviews Stealing Beauty, Bernardo Bertolucci's new movie. And for Father's Day, a story about an eccentric father by writer Sandra Singh Lowe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. FBI Director Louis Free says militia groups shouldn't believe they'll get away with facing off with the government. Free told news programs today federal law will be enforced fairly and firmly. The anti-government activists, known as the Freemen, surrendered to authorities last night. They'll be arraigned on federal charges today. They face accusations including circulating millions of dollars in bad checks and threatening to kill a federal judge. Two Freemen face new charges relating to the bad checks. A published report says federal authorities are looking for criminal involvement in the ValuJet crash in the Everglades. Bruce Dorton of Peach State Public Radio reports.
Business Week magazine says preliminary targets of the probe are ValuJet and Sabertech Incorporated. Sabertech is the maintenance contractor which has acknowledged mistakenly labeling a box containing oxygen canisters as empty when the canisters were in fact full. The canisters are the suspected cause of a fire in the cargo hold of the plane which crashed in the Florida Everglades May 11th, killing all 110 people aboard. Atlanta-based ValuJet has confirmed there's an investigation into possible criminal activity, but it says it remains confident the company is innocent of any wrongdoing. Sabertech says it has nothing to hide and is cooperating with authorities. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Atlanta.
Presidential candidate Bob Dole says the Food and Drug Administration is spending too much time debating if it should regulate nicotine. The likely GOP nominee says he backs proposals to stop children from smoking, but he says he's not sure if the FDA has the jurisdiction to reclassify cigarettes as a drug. Dole made the remarks at a campaign stop in Louisville, Kentucky. He says he wishes the FDA would spend more time approving drugs that help people. The president of Indonesia's Garuda Airlines defended his company's safety record today, while aviation investigators sifted through the wreckage of a company jet. It crashed yesterday in southern Japan, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
The head of Indonesia's state-run airline said the company had had no accidents on flights like yesterday's between Japan and Indonesia for 33 years. It apparently hasn't had many Japanese-speaking flight attendants either. Inability to speak the language on the part of Garuda's crew was a chief complaint among the 256 Japanese vacationers who boarded the ill-fated flight bound for Bali yesterday. The company has promised changes. Meanwhile, investigators sifted through the charred remains of the DC-10 for clues to the crash that killed three passengers and injured more than 100. The plane was airborne only seconds before it crashed to the ground and was consumed in flames. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 14 points at 5,643. This is NPR. The prime minister of the Bosnian Serb says indicted war criminal Radovan Karadzic could run for office in elections this September. The move would be a direct violation of the Dayton Peace Accords. Representatives of more than 40 countries are meeting in Florence, Italy, to review compliance of the Bosnian peace plan. NPR's Silvia Pujoli reports from Florence.
Gojko Klitschkovic told reporters today that the Bosnian Serb president could be a candidate in the September elections. Under the Dayton plan, indicted war criminals cannot run in elections, let alone continue to remain in office. Klitschkovic, recently installed by Radovan Karadzic to replace a prime minister he considered too independent, said that Karadzic has withdrawn from public political life and is currently occupied with reorganizing his political party and pursuing international economic contacts. But he added that the Bosnian Serb leader will continue his work to complete the creation of a state. The issue of apprehending indicted war criminals has dominated the two-day Florence meeting, a sign that international pressure on this issue is growing. But none of the official speakers offered a specific timetable or method on how this could be achieved. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Florence.
New York police have a suspect in custody they believe was involved in a series of attacks against women. John Royster is being arraigned in connection with the murder of a dry cleaning shop owner and the savage beatings of three other women. One beating includes that of a piano teacher found assaulted in Central Park. The nation's largest Protestant denomination is targeting Jews for conversion. The Southern Baptist Convention voted yesterday to proclaim the gospel to the Jews. Jewish groups denounced the resolution. Rabbi Leon Klinicki told the New York Times he's saddened by the decisions and that Christians should think about the Holocaust before launching a mission to the Jews. Other Christian groups like Catholics and Methodists encourage interfaith dialogue but not conversions. The Baptist resolution says this position denies that Jews must come to Christ to be saved. This is NPR.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Penguin Books, publishers of Penguin Classics. For 50 years, the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Bill T. Jones, has a beautiful body. He shaped it as a runner. He was very fast. And then in college, he began dancing. He's now internationally known as the co-founder of Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane & Company. Zane, who was Jones' partner on and off the stage, died of AIDS in 1988. Jones, who was HIV positive, drew on the experiences of people with life-threatening illness in his piece Still Here, which was recently broadcast on public TV. His company just opened a 2-week season at the Joyce Theater in New York. The New York Times dance critic Anna Kiselgoff called their new piece Ursinate a tour de force. I spoke with Jones in September after the publication of his memoir, Last Night on Earth. He wrote this description of his body as a young dancer. My feet were big, flat, and did not have high, supple arches. I was not lithe and swan-like. My buttocks were hard and pronounced. My chest was barrel-shaped, and it jutted forward. My carriage was low, grounded and round, not pulled up and elongated. Jones liked to say this is the body he got from his parents.
For lack of a better word, sometimes I glibly say it comes from 300 years of selective breeding. Now, this is the body of people who loaded potatoes onto trucks all day. This is the body that a woman who could carry the child into the day of labor and be out working in potatoes and then go to the hospital and be back in the field 2 weeks later. That's the body. Now, yes, it's true. This is the body that was trained as an athlete and the body that was finding its way in a world that was changing its appraisal of what a black body is and what a man's body is. And this body, I use it now as part of that discourse. I use when to take the shirt off, when to look you and the audience in the eye and move the hips suggestively, when to close down. These things, I use my body as a kind of a symbol, a cipher, that is a proving ground on some levels. And it's an aging body.
I learned a lot about you from the book that I really had no idea about. I mean, I knew that you came to dance fairly late, that you weren't classically trained as a child. But I learned that your parents were migrant workers mm-hmm. when you were young. Mm-hmm. How many years did you travel around before settling?
Well, you have to realize that the family is a very big group. It starts, my mother had her first child when she was 15. And then she had 13 more. So by the time she and my father started migrating, I don't think I was even born. And I was born in 52, and they stopped migrating in about 55 and became what at that time was called stagnants. In other words, itinerant workers who have decided to settle down in one area but have not been in an area for enough years to be considered residents. I went to school K through 12 in the upstate community of Wayland, New York, Steuben County, where my father was picking potatoes and fruits and vegetables. And I think the business sort of folded. It ended, as I said, migrating in 55, and they stopped doing the gathering of fruits and vegetables probably in the early 60s.
So were you... Were most of your friends when you were very young the children of other migrant workers?
No, there were not that many other migrant workers in the area. This is, I think, central to who I have become as a person and I think who I am as an artist, and that my dad decided to become a black Yankee. He forfeited all of the cultural soil of the South for economic opportunities and educational opportunities for his children, and that was part of the great American story. Suddenly, I was speaking a language that my parents did not speak. Suddenly, I had values that they could not have. Suddenly, I had a point of reference culturally and so on that they could not have, and they had been told it would all be good for me, and yet they were no longer even able to assess what it was and who it was I was becoming. And that's one reason in Last Night on Earth I spend a lot of time talking about them and the colorful and often painful history that took me from being the son of a migrant worker to a young social dropout in the 60s, even though how can you drop out of something that was never really yours to begin with, and moved on to becoming an artist working in a very esoteric art form called modern dance.
One of the differences between you and your parents, your parents, or at least your mother, was a real believer. I mean, she was a fundamentalist and was very
is
very much guided by her faith. And I was wondering if you ever shared her faith.
Do I share? Yes, I share it right now. I don't need Jesus Christ, but I do have a feeling that there is something that unites you and I, Terry. I believe that there is intelligence in the universe. I don't believe in sin, but I do believe that there is a consciousness, spirit, if you like, that does unite us all. And I am, as I grow deeper and as a man and as I age, and I'm trying to understand what is going on here and what is the meaning of it. And I think that this is something that she has always understood. And so I listen more closely to her prayers now. Not so much about Jesus, but about what it means to live. What do you need to believe to live?
Wasn't part of her prayers at one time that you would cease being gay and become straight?
You know, I never remember her praying that. No, I must say, she never prayed that. She always wanted us to see the truth of life. Now, I'm sure if you pressed her, she would rather I was married with children. But, you know, when Uncle Tom's Cabin was going on, every night she toured with me, and she would stand up on stage, and it was a section I gave her. My intention was to demonstrate a form that I thought was on the border of theater and ritual. I was demonstrating it in a postmodern context, that of a dance performance. But for her, what she was doing was offering a benediction that evening. And I'm very proud of that. And she'd say, "Oh, Lord," she'd call out to the Lord as I'm standing next to her improvising, dancing, "aid my son in doing whatever it is he thinks he's doing up here." And I think that's...
That's funny.
Yes, she would. She would. She's there for me. And she believes that, you know, there was nudity in Uncle Tom's Cabin. I remember her saying, "Well, son, you know, you never see pictures of the Savior. He's always half-dressed, too." You know, I mean, she would translate everything in a way that she would understand it. And she is there. She's behind me. And believe me, with all of the controversy that's been, you know, floating around me in the last year, she stood strong. And my mother is, you know, confirmed believer that men are men and women are women and that we're here to have children. I mean, she herself said, "You got to have children until the Lord shuts them off." She doesn't believe in abortion. She doesn't believe in home. She's had 13, 14 kids. But she would not get in the way of my life. This has not been easy. We've had to talk a lot and, quote, soul search a lot. It was very difficult for me to get my mother to say the word gay initially, even to say the word AIDS. But it's an ongoing, dear relationship.
Didn't you do an onstage dialogue with her once?
Yes, I did. I did. It was, as a matter of fact, the first prototype for a piece which found its way into Uncle Tom's Cabin. It was called Faith, and we did it at a dance festival out in Los Angeles, and I asked her to read her favorite passage from the Bible, and then I was going to ask her questions about faith, my premise being faith is a slave religion. When blacks came to this country, they were forced to get down and at gunpoint and accept Jesus Christ. And I said to her, you know, how is this possible that you could believe in a religion that was forced on us at gunpoint? And she said, "Well, you know, we were over in Africa worshiping trees and rocks, and if it took slavery to introduce us to the true master, then slavery was worth it." I thought that was a very strong thing to hear. But from the reading I have done and the investigation I've done with many people of faith and people of color, this is their faith is unflappable. And that was my point, not so much to tackle the historical validity or the political correctness of what she said, but to get in touch with that elusive quality, which is called faith, which I think many of us, myself included, intellectuals, late 20th century creators, are lacking, an infrastructure of belief in something greater than ourselves, or maybe which in fact defines ourselves.
My guest is dancer and choreographer Bill T. Jones. So do you think that the passion that your mother has always felt in her faith is the kind of passion you brought to dance?
That I bring to dance?
Yeah, that you bring to dance.
Mm-hmm. I would like it to be the passion I bring to every waking moment. Now, excuse me if I get too metaphorical or metaphysical, but it's true, Terry. Life right now for me literally is from breath to breath. Anxiety wells up in my chest. When you ask me questions, when I leave this, the next appointment, what will my health be like next week, next year? And it's about every moment finding a way to deal with anxiety, reaffirming one's social agenda, one's life agenda, and getting on to the next moment. That is how I view things now.
How is your health? I know you are.
I am asymptomatic, and mm-hmm. I could run around the block right now if I needed to.
Mm-hmm. To me, anxiety means tension, and tension always settles in part of my body. Mm. You know, I have my shoulder tension, my neck tension, my headache tension, the jaw tension, you know.
Yeah. Well, I have it right in the center of my chest. It's fear, and you find yourself not breathing, hyperventilating on the top.
Right.
And making silly choices.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes being angry when silence would have been best. That sort of thing, or making a snap decision when to postpone it would have been best. That's what tension does for me. It's fear oftentimes.
Well, when the tension settles in your chest or when you find yourself breathing differently, how does that affect you as a dancer? I mean, like when my tension settles in my neck, at least I don't have to be dancing.
<You know? laughs> Right. Well, you know, in the book, I talk a good deal about what it was like to be a runner. And when you run, and I was a sprinter, and I was pretty good. And there's an instance where I'm talking about the crunch of the cinders, and suddenly you see the tape, and there's this thing behind your rib cage, between your lungs, that goes click and says, now. And then there's a gush of adrenaline, and one thrusts forward, and there's that tape snapping across the pectorals. That is the same thing I feel now on the stage. It is in the middle of an intense conversation like we're having, the thing that says, this is it, Bill. There is no moment but this moment. Give it. Go for it. This is the last moment. This is the first moment. And that is where my dancing comes from at its best. That place right behind the sternum and between the lungs.
And so that pressure in the chest or whatever disappears, the fear stress disappears while you're performing.
Oh, no, it turns into a beautiful substance, radiant, that goes up to the cerebral cortex and down to the sexual organs. And if it's really good, it comes out into the space around you and others feel it.
For many years, you ran your company with your partner, Arnie Zane. And he was not a dancer at all. I mean, he was more a photographer and I think thought of himself as a photographer. But when you met and had a relationship and formed the company, you worked together as dancers. What was it like to work with you, to work with someone who wasn't a dancer?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the book, Last Night at Earth, I make a great point out of saying, describing the era in which we started working, everything was up for grabs.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wonderful time. Now, it might have been totally undisciplined and what have you, but we were the students of a person like Yvonne Rainer, who had done a brilliant work that said, called Trio A, that was danced almost entirely by untrained performers. We were studying a form called contact improvisation developed by a remarkable dancer, Steve Paxton, that said that any two bodies could dance together. I remember having a contact jam with a 98-pound ex-ballerina. I weigh 180 pounds, and she had me through counterlever up on her back. It was life-altering. So it was with Bill and Arnie. And Arnie was an artist through and through. Any work, as soon as he understood it conceptually, he could begin to claim it as his own. So he could roll quicker than anybody I knew. He had a kind of pugnacious, low to the ground sense of movement, and he was a fifth level karate practitioner. And his work was very much about slashing and making strong shapes in the air. My long body, my wiggles, and more dancerly way of moving made a nice counterpoint to this peculiar guy. And you looked at these two men, Bill and Arnie, and you knew obviously there was something that this grappling, and a lot of what we did was very artful grappling, represented that was deeper. It was about them. And then you thought, well, who are they? Case in point, we went to Berlin and we performed a work of ours, Blauvelt Mountain, in which I build, there's a brick wall in the back, and Arnie takes it apart and builds it down the center of the stage, and I dance freely. We were given the German Critics Award. They said the work was a brilliant depiction of the struggle between blacks and whites in America. We didn't think so. We thought we were doing what we did. We were being Bill and Arnie on stage and artfully grappling, but what they saw was something that I no longer disown. They saw something. As much as we were black and white men, they also saw that we were homoerotic, a word that I had never used before. It made us think, oh, is that what they're seeing? They're seeing our private life. And then we became more self-conscious and began to play with what they were seeing and the expectation that was brought by our bodies and the combination of two disparate bodies. And it even informs the way I choose my dance company now. I'm looking for that same kind of a volatile, insightful mix of the unexpected.
Dancer and choreographer Bill T. Jones. His company is currently performing at the Joyce Theater in New York. Coming up, a review of Bernardo Bertolucci's new movie. This is Fresh Air. It's been 15 years since director Bernardo Bertolucci made a film in his native Italy. He returned there to make Stealing Beauty, a new film starring Liv Tyler and Jeremy Irons. Our film critic John Powers tells whether it was a fruitful homecoming.
Few things can be crueler than early success. By the age of 32, Bernardo Bertolucci had already made two of the most memorable films in screen history, The Conformist and Last Tango in Paris. But the cost of these triumphs was to be saddled with expectations that no artist could hope to fulfill. Even when he won the Oscar for The Last Emperor, his admirers were disappointed. Let other directors make good movies. It was Bernardo Bertolucci's job to make masterpieces. His new movie, Stealing Beauty, is not a masterpiece. In fact, it's kind of silly, an elegantly crafted piece of romantic kitsch that lurches between visual splendor and dialogue so unintentionally hilarious you may find yourself nudging your companion in disbelief. Liv Tyler stars as Lucy Harmon, a 19-year-old American who's visiting family friends at their country house in Tuscany. Lucy wants to find out the identity of her real father, who may live in Tuscany, and she hopes to lose her virginity. In this, she's egged on by the other house guests, a gaggle of selfish expatriates that includes a grizzled sculptor, a loutish entertainment lawyer, and a dying writer played by Jeremy Irons. These older sophisticates are all masters at stealing beauty, be it the beauty of art, the beauty of the Tuscan countryside, or the beauty of Lucy herself. They feed on this young woman and then talk about it later, their delighted purrs often verging on self-parody.
Who's up and about?
I had a great night.
You met Lucy.
Oh, she's irresistible. I'm mad about it.
Now, what's that smile about?
What smile?
Now, come on, tell.
We just talked.
What did she tell you?
I have a feeling not as much as she might have done.
At first, you might believe that the movie's actually about Lucy, since she's the center of every scene. We watch her bare her breast for a painted portrait, howl along with a Courtney love song, and gaze out on the world like an underage sphinx. Bertolucci's camera is always stalking her, and Lucy's awareness of being watched may stir feelings of recognition in women who remember that moment when they first became aware of men's sexual gaze. Yet if Lucy's the movie's center, she's not actually its subject. Although Tyler dominates the movie with her visual radiance, she's ultimately a radiant blank, a screen on which other characters project their fantasies. Young men long to bed her. Older men, like Iron's character, want to watch, advise, and control her. We see Lucy through their eyes, not her own. While this ogling of Lucy is actually kind of creepy, the movie does reveal a serious truth about the world, the way older men seek to escape their mortality through contact with beautiful young women. Bertolucci makes this point brilliantly in the opening minutes, and we keep waiting for him to deepen it, to show how such attention might affect Lucy, or to explore the age-old cultural traditions that lead men to treat young women as a fountain of youth. Instead, Stealing Beauty goes off the rails, turning into a kind of classy softcore porn, especially in the voyeuristic scene of Lucy's deflowering, which comes accompanied by lovely scenery and lousy pop music. By the end, the movie has become a prime example of what it's supposed to be exposing. Rather than make Lucy come alive, Bertolucci simply steals her beauty. He treats her long legs and inscrutable eyes as a source of ravishing images, a female equivalent of the glorious Tuscan landscape. Bertolucci is now 56 years old, and frankly, this movie feels like an aging artist's attempt to reconnect with his youth. He has returned to Italy after years abroad, and like the sophisticates in the country house, he's using a beautiful young woman as a rejuvenating muse. Stealing Beauty is an extremely slight film, but it's charged with an unexpectedly poignant emotional weight. Watching it, you can feel Bertolucci yearning to recapture the days when he felt young and omnipotent, and the world didn't yet expect him to make only masterpieces.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from William Morrow, publisher of Kenneth C. Davis's new book, Don't Know Much About the Civil War, Everything You Need to Know About America's Greatest Conflict But Never Learned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
There's a new CD box set of Mel Torme's recordings, including this previously unreleased track. Coming up, an interview with Torme, and Sandra Singh Lowe has a story about her eccentric father.
What I'd give to hear those three little words. Man, that's such a wonderful phrase. To hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my days. And what I feel in my heart, they tell sincerely. No other words can tell it half so clearly. Three little words, eight little letters. It simply means I
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mel Torme has been performing for 66 of his 70 years. He made his way from child star to top-billed entertainer. Many of his recordings from 1944 to 1985 are collected in a new box set on Rhino Records. Although Torme is best known for his singing, he's also an arranger, pianist, drummer, actor, and songwriter. He wrote the Christmas song, the one that starts "Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire." I spoke with him in 1988 after the publication of his autobiography, It Wasn't All Velvet, a reference to his nickname, The Velvet Fog. Let's first listen to a 1956 recording from the new box set. This is Something's Gotta Give.
When an irresistible force such as you meets an old immovable object like me, you can bet, as sure as you live, something's gotta give, something's gotta give, something's gotta give.
Mel Torme has been performing since the age of 4, so he was performing during the time his voice changed. I asked him if that gave him any problems.
It did as a radio actor. I was a child radio actor from 1934 to about 1940. And when my voice did change, all those real kids' parts that I had, I was in that strange transitional period vocally where I wasn't being offered as many child radio acting parts as I had in the past. But by that time, I was so immersed in jazz and the playing of drums, in singing, even in this, you know, sort of 14-year-old froggy voice of mine, that really, I didn't really notice too much in the way of transition. Everything seemed to just kind of shift gears and go, I would say, rather smoothly.
Mm-hmm. You were on the road, I think, for the first time when you were about 17 with the Ben Pollock Band. And what was it like to be 17 playing with a lot of guys who were, for the most part, considerably older than you were?
It was tough. And by the way, Ben Pollock put that band together, Terry, but it was the Chico Marx band, you know, the Marx brother who played piano and used to shoot the keys when he zipped up the upper scale of the piano. It was tough. I got a lot of comeuppance, as they say in the Magnificent Ambersons, and some of it was deserved, frankly. Some of it wasn't, but I can look back now and realize that it was the natural progression of youth, you know, puberty, adolescence, and you finally get to be a young man, and then you get to be an old man if you live long enough.
What did you have to do to prove yourself?
I think, well, a couple of things. First of all, as I mentioned, and it wasn't all velvet, they were absolutely determined to see me finally and irrevocably lose my virginity. And the whole band seemed to be in on this, and it finally happened in Pittsburgh with a very lovely woman who was considerably older, not considerably, but somewhat older than myself. And, no, wait a minute, I guess considerably. I was 17, she was about 34. But generally speaking, I think the only way you can prove yourself with the older element of a band like that when you're as young as I was literally to keep on keeping on, to just keep learning, to try to do better all the time, and to prove yourself by virtue of your professionalism.
Well, when you were playing a song for Glenn Miller, Miller said to you, don't write Moon, June, Spoon kind of lyrics. What effect did that have on you? Did that make you think more about rhymes?
Oh, absolutely. Not about rhyme. Not about rhyme. Because that's not what he was talking about. He was talking about content.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about making pictures with lyrics. And he recommended that I listen to every lyric that Johnny Mercer had ever written. And he was absolutely right. Mercer became my role model as a songwriter and lyric writer particularly. And I began to realize that you could write something, I don't want to say profound, but redemptive in the popular song field without literally leaning on the tried and true narrow parameters of the popular song.
I want to ask you about a song that you wrote, a song you wrote early on in your career called Born to be Blue. Did you write this after Glenn Miller gave you his little lecture?
Oh, yes, yes. At least, I think it was 4 to 5 years after I spoke to Glenn Miller. And I wrote that with Bob Wells, who was my songwriting partner.
That's true. You didn't write the lyric.
Well, no, that's not true. No,
oh, okay.
No. Bob Wells and I were a team in the purest sense of the word because Bob was extremely musical as well as an extremely fine lyric writer. And I was purely a lyric writer as well, hopefully, as a composer of popular type song music. So when we worked together, even on the Christmas song and Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire, he contributed to the melody, I contributed a lot of the lyrics. And that's the way we worked.
Let me play a recording that you made of your song Born to Be Blue in the mid-40s with Sonny Burke and his orchestra. And let's listen to a little of Mel Torme singing his own song, Born to Be Blue.
Some folks were meant to live in clover, but they are such a chosen few. And clover being green is something I've never seen, 'cause I was born to be blue. When there's a yellow moon above me, they say there's moonbeams I should view. But moonbeams being gold are something I can't behold, 'cause I was born to be blue.
We'll get back to our interview with Mel Torme after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1988 interview with Mel Torme. He has a new CD box set. Let's get back to the mid-1940s, around the time that the recording we just heard was made. You sang at the Copa in New York at that time. And this was a turning point for you in a way, kind of a bad experience. You'd gotten this big build-up as the Velvet Fog, which you were nicknamed by one of the New York DJs. And you thought that build-up really worked against you in performance.
I'm not so sure about performance, Terry, but I think it did work against me from the standpoint of the fact that I was sort of shoved down the New York collective throat.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of course, the critics, the people in the press media, the print media, they all said basically to the disc jockeys, quit inundating the airwaves with this guy and telling us that he's the greatest thing since chopped liver. We'd like to discover that for ourselves, not have you. There was great rivalry, particularly in those days, between the power of the so-called disc jockey and the press. Who was more influential? And I was kind of caught in the nutcracker.
You were also kind of caught in the middle of two generations, too, weren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I came onto the Copa stage at a time when the Copa was playing nobody except the considerably older performers, the Sophie Tuckers, the you know, Joey Lewis's, Jimmy Durante. Those were the staples at the Copa. Now here comes this squirt from California, and he's going to entertain us? Come on. And consequently, I really got my lumps at the Copa, some of which, again, I deserved.
Well, you said you had to sing in a falsetto then, and listening to your records from the mid-40s, I don't hear what you mean.
No. I don't know where that came from, but I don't even know how to sing falsetto. As a matter of fact, you know, my range in the last several years has increased on the upper end as well as the lower end by at least 3 or 4, maybe 5 notes. And when I sing very high notes in some of the records that I've made with George Shearing and even on my own, some absolutely ill-informed critics say he even sounds good in falsetto. I can't produce. I don't know how to produce a falsetto note. What those notes are what singing teachers call covered tones. They're done up in the head, but they are absolutely pure. They have nothing to do with mechanical or ersatz formation of notes. I didn't sing in a falsetto way in those days, Terry, but I did sing in rather a wispy, kind of creamy, and I felt rather callow way. And consequently, I couldn't bear to hear the sound of my voice on records in those days. Not that I'm that wild about it today, but at least now I can tolerate, because of the aging process, because my voice has deepened, and because I think I've learned a little more about singing than I knew back in 1947 at the Copa, I can tolerate what I record on record.
Well, you said that you used to sing in a head tone, and now you're singing with your diaphragm.
Right.
What's the difference between the two, and how did you start to change?
I think you mainly produce head tones, obviously, in the head. Breathing, of course, is everything in singing. But I taught myself to breathe from the diaphragm. And I can produce notes now that are very powerful. I'm a far, far more robust singer than I used to be in those days. And that is more pleasing to my personal ear. Beyond that, as I say, I taught myself my own sort of breathing exercise to the point where I can hold a note, for instance, at the end of a song almost interminably. And I think that's terribly important that you're able to control your breathing, particularly for phrasing of lyrics.
Well, here's what I want to do. I want to play a record you made in 1956 of Nice Work If You Can Get It, the Gershwin song. I don't know what you think about this recording, but we're about to find out. and I should mention, as you probably know, that this was singled out by the people who did the American Popular Song Anthology for the Smithsonian Collection of Recordings. And this is a collection of some of the greatest American popular songs. And they did their attempt to find the definitive recordings of these great songs. And so your recording of Nice Work If You Can Get It was chosen. This was made in 1956. I should say it's with the Marty Paich Dectet, which is the group that you are reunited with on right. Your new record. So let's give this a spin and then see what you think of it.
Okay.
Holding hands at midnight, 'neath the starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Strolling with the one girl, sighing sigh after sigh. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Just imagine someone waiting at the cottage door, where two hearts become one. Who could ask for anything more? Loving one who loves you, and then taking that vow. Nice work if you can get it, and if you get it, won't you tell me how?
It's Mel Torme as recorded in 1956. So what do you think?
Not bad.
Yeah, I concur.
Well, I wasn't that terrible. No, actually it sounds pretty good. I was sort of hit and miss in those days because I was still earning my wings. My whole career, as I point out in this book of mine, is a work in progress. The learning curve is always there. Whitney Balliot did a big profile on me in the New Yorker magazine about 4 or 5 years ago. And when he asked me why all this wonderful things, this wonderful stuff is happening for me right now, this tremendous renaissance of my career and everything, I looked him right in the eye and said, Whitney, I'm learning how to sing. And he really gave me a look that said, my God, what an ingenuous remark. I said, no, Whitney, don't look at me that way. I'm telling you, point blank, I am learning how to sing. I do that, Terry, literally every day of my life. And that's not a phony modesty remark. I am, I think, on a daily basis, learning a little more about myself, learning how to be more consistent, how to concentrate more on what I sing. And I hope that's to the good.
Mel Torme recorded in 1988. There's a new 4-CD box set called the Mel Torme Collection on Rhino Records.
That certain night, the night we met, there was magic abroad in the air. There were angels dining at the Ritz, and a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. I may be right, I may be wrong, but I'm perfectly willing to swear that when you turned and smiled at me, a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square.
This is Fresh Air. This month was the national debut of a public radio program called This American Life. The program is finding original and absorbing ways of using radio to tell personal stories. We're showcasing excerpts of the program from time to time on Fresh Air. The host and producer of This American Life is Ira Glass. Here's Ira to introduce the story we're going to hear today.
One of the performers who's come onto This American Life from time to time talking about her family is Sandra Tsing-Low. Sandra is a columnist for Buzz magazine in Los Angeles. She's sort of one of these overachievers who does 1,000 different things. She's a columnist. She's got a new book of essays out. She tells stories on stage. She composes and plays her own music. In fact, this music you're hearing right now is Sandra. Sometimes you can hear this music. Is that filler music? On Morning Edition. I guess it's not really nice to call it filler music, but, you know, that music that they play in between the stories. Anyway, Sandra has come onto This American Life now 4 different times, telling stories about her father. And the one that we're going to play right now is one of her more memorable stories. It captures in miniature a lot about one father-daughter relationship.
I insist that this be the last radio commentary about my father. Okay, maybe I've never talked about him on the radio before. I just don't want this to become a habit. Understand that for years, stories about my father, anecdotes that I thought were throwaways, were the only thing anyone would ever remember about me. There I'd stand at parties, one hip jutted out, trying to tell amusing yet compelling stories about myself. at which point the dark-eyed man I was speaking with would lean forward, rest a hand lightly on my arm, and murmur, "You know, I've been wondering for years." "Yes," I'd breathe. A flame would leap into his eyes. "How is your dad? Does he still wear his underwear backwards and do the Chinese snake dance on Pacific Coast Highway?" I'd close my eyes in pain. "No, of course not." "Well, yes. First, let's take a step backwards. Forget my dad. Immigrant parents in general tend towards eccentricity, don't they? They arrive from the old country. Now they have VCRs and Cuisinarts. Their children are growing up to be monsters. And worse, the local Ralph stops carrying pig knuckles. For the record, my father does not wear his underwear backwards, only his sweaters. When the elbows wear through, you just turn them around and keep going. And yes, for the record, he did perform the Chinese snake dance for us kids, naked, armed only with a fluttering beach towel as he leapt and twirled, imparting his ancient Chinese folk song with a mournful howl. I know this may sound strange, but I've brought my father into the studio today to sing it. Papa?
Okay, this so-called snake song, actually I borrowed from old Chinese shepherd song. It sounds like this. 天上的树啊，什么人来开？地下的王后，什么人来开？
Dad's lived in Malibu for some 30 years now, threatening to cause property values to tumble along with him. Pop, I'm going to tell the story now and the way I tell it, so I hope you're not embarrassed. Okay?
Okay. What choice do I have?
What? Once a neighbor called the police to complain. My father was hanging out his old underpants to dry, Shanghai style, on clotheslines strung out in front of the garage. The underpants had holes in them. The complaint calls eventually stopped, but questions remain. Does my father, a retired aerospace engineer with science degrees from Stanford, Purdue, and Caltech, have to wear old underpants with holes in them? Is this a person who can afford, say, new underpants and a Maytag dryer, perhaps? Why, yes, would have to be the answer. Right, Papa?
Yeah.
My father is one of those people who have untold stocks, bonds, mutual funds, IRAs, whatever, that they are continually shifting from one account to the next. For all his money, though, my father has always transported himself in and out of Malibu via hitchhiking. Yes, he owns his own car. He even bought me one, a Hyundai. He had to shelter income. But he doesn't like to drive. Say why.
Oh, because the pollution, also the petroleum reserve only have 50 years. So we have to save this for the next generation.
But you particularly like hitchhiking.
Hitchhiking can meet lots of people.
Mm-hmm, especially in Los Angeles. Now, beloved listeners, this is my commentary, so I'm going to try and give you my point of view, what I see. Usually I'm driving through Santa Monica, and I'll come by, like, let's say the corner of Wilshire and 4th, and there my father will be standing, clutching his lucky grocery bag of scientific papers, trying to flag down a ride. I'll never not pick him up. That would be a little too how sharp the serpent's tooth. But I have been tempted to just put my foot on the gas pedal and race towards the Pacific happy and free, like somebody whose 75-year-old dad is not still copping rides from the public. Okay, this is your section. Okay. Let's talk about the day you got the really good ride, and where were you standing?
First, I always got good ride, but that was a special good ride. I just come from dentist's office in the late afternoon on Wilshire Boulevard near Western, and the first car stopped. A very gracious lady looked like Loretta Young. She drove a...
Looked like who?
Loretta Young. You don't know, because very... Oh, movie star, very gracious lady, Loretta Young.
Oh, like a Chinese movie star.
No, it's American, Loretta.
Loretta Young.
Loretta Young, I'm sorry.
Loretta Young. Okay, Loretta Young.
Loretta Young.
Okay.
And she very gracious. I mean, without no hesitation, let me in the back seat of her four-door Mercedes sedan because in the front seat, the passenger seat was occupied by a young man. So then we talk of different things. I say, what kind of business you people in? They say, a movie business. Oh, I say, that's exciting.
Did she? You said she had known a lot about Chinese opera and film?
Oh, yes. We discussed many Chinese movies, so she knows quite a lot. And then somehow we talk about Clinton. And the lady say, yeah, I like both Hillary and Bill. We were in the White House recently. Then I say, what's your name? She say, Angelica Houston. I say, wow, I don't go movies. I don't know much movie stars. But I do know Houston family because your father, John Houston, passed a few years away. I have kept the track on your family story.
Note that's an important point for my father because unlike Ms. Houston, I didn't go into my father's business science and it's been a little disappointing. But she gave you a letter, right?
I asked her, can you give me your autograph? For finally, she turned the envelope back. It said like this, to Mr. Lowe. It was a pleasure to have you in my car. Then their heart with two wings. Then love, Angelica Houston. They down there, XXXX. Being Chinese, I don't know what the XXX mean. Then later I asked my friend, they say, that's kissing, 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 you know.
Okay, so there's the story. Here's the way I remember my dad first telling me and ending this. I remember you said that while Angelica Houston was a good ride, she wasn't a dream ride. Because she had this friend to drop off in Beverly Hills, which took you a little out of your way. And at that point, it would have been quicker for you to take the crosstown bus because you had to transfer. But by then, I remember you lowered your voice. You're an expert in such delicate matters of decorum. And you said that you thought at that point, getting out might be a little rude. Papa, why don't you just take us out with a song?
Another song?
Yeah.
This song usually I sing with my wife. Since today Sandra didn't invite my wife, I have to let her stay in the kitchen at home. This song describes a young woman longing for her lover. Sounds like this. 天涯爱聚 你呀，米子呀，秀美美香港小乡亲，狼牙咱们俩是一条心。哎呀哎哎呦啊，狼牙咱们俩是一条。
Sandra Singh Low is a writer, performer, and composer. She's the author of the book Depth Takes a Holiday, Essays from a Lesser Los Angeles. She tells stories about her father in a one-woman show called Aliens in America that opens June 26th at Second Stage in New York City. The story we heard was produced for the new public radio program This American Life, which premiered nationally this month. Our thanks to producer Ira Glass. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Ferrer, Strauss, and Giroux, publisher of Messages from My Father, a new memoir by Calvin Trillin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.